The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to City Bible Forum today. Thank you for being here today on How Can One Person Make a Difference? Amber Hawks is going to be our speaker today as General Counsel for the International Justice Mission, which is a human rights agency that secures rescue for victims of slavery, sexual exploitation, and other forms of violent oppression. We're going to get Amber up here in a moment. We're just going to interview her shortly. Thanks so much for being here today. But for those of you who maybe your first time coming along to City Bible Forum, or if it's been a while, we want to welcome you. My name is Russell Matthews. We're currently in a series on Can We Make a Difference, or Can You Make a Difference, and looking at different components of making a difference. Last week was our forum. And this week and next week, we'll be looking at kind of some of the bigger picture ideas of can we make a difference. If it's your first time coming along, just to explain kind of how things will go today, as I'm going to do a short interview with Amber, and then she's going to give a talk for about 25 minutes or so. During that time, we encourage you to take down notes. You can look at some of the different information that she has inside of the outline for you. Also, if you have questions, we'd really encourage you to ask questions. That's why we call it City Bible Forum. It's an opportunity for you to ask questions of our speaker. We encourage you to write those questions down on the slip of paper while she's giving the talk. And then after, I'll kind of give some short announcements on some of the things going on around at City Bible Forum in the city. And then Amber will come up and take the remaining part of our time, be able to answer as many questions as she can. Our goal is to be done by about 10 to the hour, so you'll be able to get back to work on time. All right. Without further ado, Amber, if you want to come on up. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
Good. Yeah. Thanks so much. I'll let you speak into the microphone. And well, thanks for being here today. More than anything, just kind of get to know you and meet you and everything. So obviously, we kind of can see based on your the information that we have in the outline and also here. But you want to tell us a little bit about yourself? You didn't grow up here, or you did grow up here, but you're not originally from here. Is that how it was? I was trying to understand that yesterday.
Yeah, I spent some time in my childhood in a couple of different places. I was born in England, but, you know, I consider myself Australian. I sound Australian, obviously. And in Hong Kong, actually.
Oh, wow, there you go.
Yeah, but most of the time I've actually lived in Australia, by and large. So, yeah, live here with my family, my husband, and my two kids, Sabella, who's 4, and William, who is 2.
All right.
Yeah, and they're back at home making mischief while
I'm here. There you go. You get to go home to that tonight.
Yeah, it's awesome.
There you go.
Yeah.
Justice done there, too.
Yeah.
As a mom. So, interesting, because, I mean, looking at what you do, I mean, an opportunity, also your background, there's so many things you could be doing. Why the International Justice Mission?
Yeah, well, why to begin with? It was just an uncanny story of my husband and I deciding to go overseas and do some work, which I'll talk a bit more about later, and me randomly Googling India and justice and finding a blog that wasn't meant to be on the internet at all that pointed me towards this organization, and that's how I found out about it. And I think a month later I was in India working with IJM. But why staying with this organization and why still working with this organization? Because I've seen how they make a difference, and I've felt that I have been making a difference with them, and have been impressed by the work that International Justice Mission does. But I'll share a bit more about
that. Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for being here. There is information on the back table, and you can sign up to get more information, too, and some books, and I'll explain that later. But I'll let you go ahead and talk.
Thanks. I'm glad that you're all here today. I'm glad that perhaps maybe you're interested in International Justice Mission, or maybe you're interested in just hearing about my experience in the field, or interested in just discussing or exploring how one person, how you might be able to make a difference. So just by way of background, as Russ said, International Justice Mission is a human rights agency, and we work to protect people from violence. violence such as sex trafficking, slavery, illegal land grabbing, illegal detention, police brutality, and also sexual assault. Now, I first began working for International Justice Mission in 2006 in Chennai in India. And I actually ended up there leading a team of local Indian lawyers fighting cases against forced labour slavery. Now, that slavery was not in the sex industry, so that wasn't sex trafficking work that I was doing there. But these were cases in other industries, so agricultural, industrial cases. And I was meant to be there for 6 months, but I actually ended up being there for 2 years. And after returning home from doing that work, I then did a stint with as a lawyer with the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, undertaking cases of some more human trafficking, some child pornography, some child sex tourism. And here I am today, and my role currently is to lead the establishment of International Justice Mission's Australian Partner Office. Now, here in Australia, we will exist to expand and enhance the casework that we do overseas in the field that I'm going to talk about. And we won't be doing that casework on those cases here in Australia, so I guess maybe this is my post-lawyer phase of life. But we will be recruiting for the field and for our work here. We'll be raising funds. We'll be raising support in the form of prayer support, as we're a Christian organisation. We will be doing some government advocacy and policy work here too. But I can answer questions about that later. And I do really want to share with you some of my experience from the field today in India. But just before I do that, to give us all some context on what we're talking about here, we need to sort of think about what it is that the problem is in the world. And at the moment, there are actually 4 billion people that live outside the protection of the law. That's 60% of the world's population. It's hard to picture what this means, but basically, if you think about a situation where we are a victim of a crime or fearful that we you know, we're threatened with assault or something like that, we can pick up the phone, we dial 000, whatever, and we lodge a complaint. And by and large, the police act. By and large, they'll respond, they'll start an investigation, and they'll follow through on that. And we have some kind of protection. But not so for the poor. They are preyed on because they are weak and because there are people stronger than them who can just benefit off them. The experience for the poor around the world, we often think about hunger and we think about those things that they don't have, but one of the things they don't have is a protector. They don't have protection, and so they suffer everyday violence. So what does that everyday violence look like? It looks like 2 million children in the commercial sex trade. It looks like what we used to say, 27 million people in slavery across the world today. Real slavery, not just sweatshop slavery. And I don't know if any of you read the paper this morning, but Twiggy Forrest has been in the news in London, and he's been sort of become passionate about this issue of slavery, and he has founded an organisation called Walk Free, and they've just released the Global Slavery Index. They've been researching all these countries around the world, and actually they've said it's 29 million people in slavery today. Now, there are some problems. So how can one person, how can anyone make a difference worth anything to that big a problem? If you're like me, then stats can be a little bit overwhelming. They can be a little bit paralyzing. They make us feel numb, I think, a little bit desperate. So for that reason, I'd like to tell you specifically about a case I had a chance to work on in India, and introduce you to a guy named Raman. Now, like his father, Raman was born into slavery. And as is too often in the case in India, labourers are lured into brick kilns, rice mills, just like this one. rock quarries and other places with a one-time advance payment, which is like a loan that they take, a very small loan, to cover urgent medical needs, the cost of maybe food because there's been a drought because they're just too poor to afford it, maybe a dowry for a daughter. And they take these loans, but they're actually a trap that the business owners use. The laborers go into these places and then they earn just cents a day, and it barely provides them enough food to live. Meanwhile, that paltry loan that they borrowed, it's gaining exorbitant interest. And often, you know, in the cases that I've seen, they're in these places and they can eat cracked rice off the floor, but they're charged for that privilege, and that's added to their loan. Or they're given a shack or a thatched roof of some kind of shelter that's hardly a room, and they're charged also for that privilege. And they're never able to pay off that loan. If they try to leave, they are beaten, and sometimes they're killed. In Raman's case, his owner, Kandasamy, bragged about this scheme. And he actually said, yes, I've been operating like this for 25 years. When he was asked, but what about the laborers? What if they try to leave? Oh, no, they can't leave, he said. And when Raman was in fourth grade, Kandasamy decided that Raman was strong enough to carry the heavy sacks of rice now, and he forced him to drop out of school. And as Raman grew older, he married actually inside the rice mill and had four children that were destined to inherit this generational bondage, starting to work at four or five. And aside from the routine physical abuse that he endured, Raman and his family were subject to 18-hour days picking, bagging, boiling, raking rice. And he helplessly watched his wife as she frequently fainted from the heat, from utter exhaustion, pregnant often, working. And he recalls, he told our staff, how he learned to resign himself in his dreams that his children might play or go to school. We had no other choice, he said, but to continue working. Now there are some problems. Or there is one guy with a few really big problems. How can one person make a difference to Raman? How? Well, we at International Justice Mission are a group of lawyers, investigators, and social workers, and we partner with local authorities in 17 locations across the developing world. Those ones in the middle there, not the yellow ones, they're where our field officers are, where we do this casework. And when we do that work, we have these objectives, and that is to rescue the victims, to bring the criminals to justice, to restore the survivors, and to strengthen justice systems overall so that the abuse stops long term. See, through doing this casework, we come across information and opportunity that allows us to do work that literally repairs the justice system in these countries so that millions are protected from future abuse. Now, a year or so before I even arrived in India, someone other than Kandasamy had already, that's Kandasamy the owner, he had made a difference to Raman, but someone other than him had also made a difference to Raman. You see, upon learning of the forced labour in the rice mill and the abuse, my colleagues at IJM worked with local government authorities to gather evidence of the abuse and to raid the rice mill. And fearful, though, of what Kandasamy might do to them, the labourers inside were too afraid to tell the truth. And that actually jeopardised their prospects of gaining freedom when the officials came to talk to them. But courageously, Raman spoke up, one person. With his testimony, the local magistrate wrote release certificates. That's declarations of freedom from all obligation and all debt for Raman and 34 other men, women and children enslaved in that rice mill. Real people made a real difference and brought freedom to Raman. But the problem was that without holding Kandasamy accountable for these crimes, there was nothing to prevent him from just restocking his mill with new slaves. Or even worse, going and harassing Raman now that Raman was back in his village. So what we did is R.J. Ebb said about making sure that the laws were applied. Rama's family were learning to adjust to a life of freedom assisted by our social workers, and our lawyers prepared a case against Kandasamy. But in the first pre-trial hearing, when our lawyers got there, something peculiar happened, and the defence counsel made a strange statement saying that his client had already been tried and found guilty for this offence. And then he moved to dismiss the whole case on the ground of double jeopardy. Even non-lawyers in here will probably know what double jeopardy is. You can't be tried for the same offence more than once. So my colleagues learned, in fact, that while they had been preparing the case, Kandasamy had gone to his friend, the local executive magistrate, and pled guilty, was convicted of operating a bonded labour system under Indian law, and this magistrate then sentenced him to a $15 fine and imprisonment to be served, what they say is, to the rising of the court, which meant he basically sat there till the magistrate went home for the day. Unsurprisingly, the meaningless conviction emboldened Kandasamy. He restocked his mill with slaves. And he began to brag openly that no one could stop him, and he would continue to do this. He sent men to Raman's home to harass him, saying that they were going to take revenge on his family. And unfortunately, those slaves, the second generation slaves in the rice mill, were too scared to speak up this time about what was happening to them. But because he now knew that he was not alone, because of what somebody else had done, Raman was no longer afraid. So he went to the police and he filed a complaint. And finally, after a year, IJM was able to begin a second covert investigation on a tip received from Raman into that rice mill. And again, armed with proof, my colleagues planned another operation with the local government, rescuing a dozen slaves. And as a result of some awesome advocacy work by my colleagues, this time Kandasamy was charged with a serious slavery offence under the Indian Penal Code, which actually meant this time that he couldn't get his old mate, the executive magistrate, to just convict him and fine him because it was going to another court. But again, the problem is that cases in India take years and years and years to get to trial. So when I arrived in India, which was a year after all this, Kandasamy had still not been held accountable. And a new lawyer, Prabhu, had also been assigned to that case. And we all knew that Kandasamy could, whenever he wanted, to restock again with slaves. And because he wasn't held accountable, so many more people were vulnerable because it had sent a message of impunity to the slave owners around. But we were determined not to let him use his power and his connections to again slip through the cracks. So after much, much work, a second trial began for Kandasamy. And my part, actually, involved becoming a sudden expert on Indian double jeopardy law and accompanying our lawyers up to the Supreme Court in Delhi so that we could appeal the previous dismissal, which was a totally unsuccessful strategy. But the other part was mainly encouraging my team and improving the quality of their legal writing, and training Prabhu and the rest of the team on advocacy skills that they could in turn use to mentor the local prosecutors. And in the end, it was Prabhu, another individual, who worked tirelessly alongside the local prosecutor for another 3 years or so to see this through to its finish. And this time, the judge convicted Kandasamy. He sentenced him to 5 years in prison, which is the most significant conviction to date in IJM's forced labour casework in the region. There you go. It's an article on it in an Indian paper. It's actually one of the first convictions on actual slavery charges under the penal code since the 19th century. The effect of this as a deterrent goes way beyond the individuals who are held by Kandasamy. It makes a difference to thousands and thousands more whose would-be slave owners and now afraid that they too might go to jail. And today, Raman works as a construction worker so his daughters can go to school. Education's no longer a dream for them, but a reality. And he has actually himself emerged as a strong community leader in his village. He has repeatedly petitioned government officials to ensure that his community receives water, electricity, ration cards, and land grants. Over 70 families have benefited from Raman's persistence, one individual. You see, in doing this work, in taking on individual cases, we actually get some insight into what we call the justice pipeline. You'll see it up there, and it's missing a word. But anyway, the pipeline normally works like this. Injustice goes in one end. You get police, prosecutors, judges, social workers, and justice should come out the other end. But in the countries where we work, injustice goes in this end. And you see, if the police are corrupt, the prosecutors are under-resourced, the judges are ill-trained and unaccountable, the social workers are overworked, then what you get out of the other end is just more injustice. But by doing these individual cases, by pushing them through the system, we get to see exactly where that pipeline is broken. We get to tailor the work we do after that to train and mentor people in the system so that we can fix it. And in 2011, because of this casework and because of this way that we work to fix the pipeline and because of the work of many other individuals, and not just us, IJM conducted its largest operation with the Indian government, rescuing 514 individuals from a brick kiln in Chennai in one single day. But what is more is that the case was actually initiated by one of these local executive magistrates. It wasn't initiated by IJM. And that practice is becoming more and more frequent as a result of our work. Our work, which now reaches across more than 10 Indian states. And that has come from individual people making a difference. Now, I've just spent time recounting a bunch of tactics, basically, about how a few people made a big difference to a few other people in my particular field. But to really understand how one person can make a difference, I just want to take you back a little bit further and explain a little bit more. Because IJM began, and we all do what we do, and I do what I do. It has to be said, to be upfront about it, because I'm a follower of Jesus. That's actually the what, the why, the when, the where, and most importantly, the how I make a difference. It makes all the difference to how I've done things and how I'm looking to the future. See, because I know and follow Jesus, I've actually understood a couple of things that have really shaped this journey of mine. Firstly, I'm comforted because it wasn't meant to be this way, and I know that. I've learned that there was a time when people were designed not to seek to take all that they had, to use their power and their influence for their own selfish gain, to abuse others for profit. There's the possibility of an existence where people understand that all they had is God-given. And each person is created in God's image and to be loved. That's what it was meant to be. And this picture gives me something to look toward, where there is no abuse and where there is no pain. And that is a vision worth working for. And that's something that keeps me going and has been so important for this work. Secondly, I am not actually shocked or paralytically depressed about the fact that these crimes happen around the world or the magnitude of them. Yes, they are tragic. Yes, they are sad, and we should grieve for them. But I've actually understood that the world has been like this for a very, very long time. One of the oldest stories of slavery in history is of the Jews being abused and oppressed as slaves by the Egyptians. Before that, even, Joseph was sold, along with his Technicolor dream coat, by his brothers into slavery. That's human trafficking. I know that for the longest of times, people have been abusing power, and and there has been injustice. That is, people have been using what they've got, using their own power that they've been given, to take from others the good things that God wants them to have, their life, their liberty, their dignity, and the fruits of their love and labour. So I am not paralysed or shocked, and that's an actual advantage. Thirdly, and most importantly, I have actually a source of courage and a source of hope when I do this work. I believe, but I've also really experienced that God is not indifferent to injustice. He loves justice. He cares and he acts. Joseph, who he loved, ended up second in charge of the whole of Egypt. He heard the cry of his people in slavery and he brought them out. He was actually moved to act. And when Jesus came to earth, he began his ministry with this statement. The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed. See, I know that he came to put relationships back together, to restore them to a place that there's peace, peace between man and God, and peace between man and man. Yes, it seems a bit like spiritual speak, but it's so much more than that. It's so practical. It's about restoring everything so that there is no crying, no pain, and no abuse anymore. God is not indifferent. He cares and he acts. He was so committed that he died just to make peace between us and God and to see all those relationships restored to the way they should be. And I take courage and hope from that. So why and how do I do what I do? I just follow him in. That's the call, actually, in the foundation of IJM's work. We learn to do good, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, and plead for the widow. And I know through experience that I'm actually the part of the plan to continue God's restoration of all things, which is pretty darn cool. And I do this because I trust that it's actually him that is working through me. And the more I've actually stepped out and done it, I've realized that he has provided all that I've needed. It doesn't mean that things didn't go wrong. Did you just listen to that story? It took years to get that outcome. And essentially, at one point, we were just out-lawyered in the middle of it. It doesn't mean we don't get things wrong. And maybe that whole process sounds a bit pie in the sky to you about how Jesus led me there, but I want to tell you that it's true and I've lived it. How did I end up doing what I'm doing today? Making a difference? It's no hocus pocus. My thoughts on doing law at university went something like this. I've heard the word God and justice in one sentence a lot of times. God must like justice. Law has something to do with justice. Maybe I should study law. Then I could help people. That was it. So intellectual. And I went on my way through law school largely disliking it and working for a big firm down the road. But over a couple of years, I became quite uncomfortable. I was sitting in a comfy office. I did have a lot of work, but enough food and clothes. But I didn't feel particularly alive. I felt like a square peg in a round hole. And that was just me, though. That's just my experience. But it was actually a step of trust that led me into this work. And after becoming increasingly restless, I just put it all on the line. Where next, God? Wherever you say, I'm there, I trust you. And being who he is, he led me where he did. And frankly, I had no idea where I was going to end up. And I just followed. And I could never have predicted that I would be here talking to you about this today. I could never have predicted I would move to India. Honestly, it used to be one of my least desirable places to visit. Up there, outdone, I guess, only by some conflict zones that I didn't want to go to. And to be honest, it was a good thing that I couldn't have predicted what I was going to do. Because had I known, I'm sure I would have found an excuse not to do it. But then, what would I have missed out on? I used to start my days in the office in India, just down on my knees, just asking God to help me with this work. because I was leading a staff of 13 individuals, mostly male and mostly older than me, in a country where males and gender and age is absolutely vital to all credibility. So it was tough. But if I had not followed, I would never have met my colleagues. I would never have worked on the cases that I have. I would never have experienced the difference my very small part made to Rahman's life. I would not have seen the way that God showed up for me and for people in need. And it reminds me a little bit of this drop and these circles here. He has impacted me with joyous force, and I in turn cannot help but impact others. That is a picture of how one person, Jesus, continues to make a difference. But the last thing I just wanted to share with you today is that you don't need to be anyone in particular of any particular profession to make a particular difference. Just look at what you have. There are things you personally enjoy. There are skills you personally have. You have unique experiences, education, resources, and unique relationships, a unique world around you. We're all unique. Each of our personalities is unique. As a kid, I was just intent on justice and fairness all the time. I stood up to bullies. I made sure that my mum poured the juice in the cup exactly right. But something different might make you tick. We need to look to what we have. And you are like that drop there as you engage in the world around you with who you are and what you have. Your reach will go further than you imagine. I used what I had in India, relying on God for the rest, and I like to think that perhaps one of the outcomes is that it encouraged and equipped my colleague Prabhu, and then Prabhu used what he had, and he saw a landmark conviction. Rahman courageously used the very little that he had and changed so much for so many. It's only recently that I've been thinking about this whole ripple effect. But when I left my role in Chennai to come home a while ago now, I was given a frame by the staff, and the frame had a photo and sort of a small version of a release certificate and a plaque with a quote on it that was chosen by one of the staff. And it actually said this, which is a quote by Mother Teresa. "We ourselves feel that what we are doing is just a drop in the ocean. But if the drop was not in the ocean, I think the ocean would be less because of the missing drop. I do not agree with a big way of doing things. What matters is the individual. If we wait till we get the numbers, then we'll be lost in the numbers. And we will never be able to show that love and respect for the one person." Thanks very much.
Well, if you do have any questions for Amber, please write those questions down. I think Tor and Craig will be able to pick those up for you, so you'll get those up to Amber. I want to get her back her up quickly. But just a few announcements. If you're not currently looking at writing down any questions, if you do want information about IJM, please pick up the information back there on the back table. There's more information for you. Also, they do have some books. Some of the books that are referenced inside of your outline are available for you, and Sarah's back there. She'll be able to take care of you in regards to those. Just a couple of events coming up, just so you're aware. Just get through a couple slides here for you. Oh, feedback forms. Yes, if you have any feedback, if you'd like to give us feedback about today or also this series, we'd love to get your feedback. Also, if you don't get our regular communications, please fill in these details, and we'll make sure we get that taken care of for you. And we also, if you're interested in finding out more about Jesus, there's a series called The Short Course for the Curious. Please tick the box there, and we'll make sure we get back to you as soon as possible. Next week, we have, in continuing in the Can We Make a Difference series, we have John Dixon coming along to do a talk on how humility makes the difference. He wrote a book recently called Humilitas, on the impact that humility have had on our great leaders and high achievers throughout history. Definitely worthwhile coming along and hearing John this following week. Also, a topic that may be difficult to engage in, but definitely important, especially in light of what's going on in the media. The Smith Lecture is coming up on the topic presented by Professor Patrick Parkinson on child sex abuse in the churches, a story of moral failure, maybe something that we would want to avoid or not desire to know more about, but hearing the information and what's out there, I think it's definitely worthwhile engaging in and considering, and I think that Professor Parkinson will definitely handle this very tactfully and also engagingly. All right, Amber, I'm going to turn this back over to you.
There might be more essays coming. The first one is a very simple one. Why was the blog not supposed to be on the web? It wasn't supposed to be on the web because at the time we did not publicize our work in India externally because of the situation internally. The Indian government didn't really want it broadcast, the situation of trafficking and slavery that was going on internally. And so us broadcasting externally that we were there both jeopardized, I guess, our situation there and our ability to remain there. And we were at that time securing our relationship with the local government and we didn't want to jeopardize it. So it wasn't meant to be there. And a lawyer that had visited posted a blog, a lawyer from the UK, and when I read it, and then I applied for the job and I told them how I found out about the organisation. I noticed that the blog came down in about 2 hours or something like that. So that's that story. Into what new paradigm was Rahman rescued and how is he prospering now? The journey of someone rescued from slavery is long and it's difficult and it's different depending on what kind of slavery they've been in. If someone's been in the sex industry, a child or a woman or a boy, then they're going to need a lot of therapy and a lot of help in many different ways. In this kind of case that Rahman was in, he's rescued into a life of freedom, which is very difficult for someone who has been in slavery their whole life to manage, who has not had to make decisions for themselves. Often these people are alcoholics, or whatever they can get their hands on, abusers, because their life is pretty bad. They often suffer, have a lot of domestic violence in their families because of what they've seen modelled to them. That's how they treat each other. And so we work with them closely and we work with partner organisations on the ground. They're entitled to benefits from the government when they come out in India. We work with them for at least 2 years and we have caseworkers and social workers that follow them up and our partners provide them with practical assistance. Sometimes it comes with medical help and a lot of the time it comes with vocational training and educational training, other things, again, you know, education against domestic violence and new ways to live. New communities that they would, in this situation, in sex trafficking situations, they often cannot return to where they came from because it's dangerous, but in this situation, they go back to their villages. And people like Rahman change the situation because we can hold these meetings which educate the entire villages about the stuff that's going on. People have more self-worth and dignity and they know the dangers that are out there. They know that there are other opportunities and they don't have to go back. And you know, it's an argument that wouldn't they just go back in the next time they leave it alone, but over 90% of the people that we bring out do not go back. How is it possible in a practical sense to stop the perpetuation of this situation? Being slavery or being everyday violence for the poor. In a practical sense here in Australia, by remaining here, by being you, if that is the situation this question is talking about, then we are here to help engage people in this and to connect people to it. So we need support. A lot of us here have many resources. We have good education. We're able to speak. We're able, for those of you who are churchgoers, to invite people back to churches to speak. I speak at churches. We're very interested in church mobilisation to get people thinking about God's heart for justice and his work for justice in the world. So you can invite a speaker. You can yourself educate yourself about the injustices that are going on, and then explore the opportunities. For us, we need prayer partners. Our work around the world is based and supported on prayer, which we consider as important, if not more important than money, in doing this work. And we need your prayers. We have these emails that go out giving real-time prayer points and casework information that we need prayer on, so you can become a prayer partner with us. If you want to do that, you can sign up the back with Sarah. We need money because this is really expensive. Putting that case through the system, although it's a set of people, but it continues to have a massive effect that takes a lot of money. So you guys, we're the, top percentage of the world in terms of wealth. We have a lot more than Rahman did, and we can use what we have to make a lot of difference. So don't feel that, if you're not going to go gallivanting into a brick kiln or a rock quarry, that you can't do anything. Everything that you do with your relationships, if you consider who you know and think about it creatively and think about ways, and if you want us to help you with that, please just put your name down and we'll get in touch. But just beyond that, though, I think that it's really important to know that we actually, this injustice happens to people in our own communities. So we're passionate about seeing people look around them and notice the people that you see in your everyday life or that you might not see because they're hidden, and start to look for these situations of injustice. Educate yourself on what exists around you and on the opportunities that there are to help those people as well, and not just these. I think that's it. Thanks.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.